Chapter 40. Humiliator, Humiliatee. I was stunned when the act finally passed. And another person was too. Vladimir Vladimirovich Putin. For the previous few years, Putin had sat comfortably in the Kremlin, knowing that whatever happened in the U.S. Congress, President Obama opposed the Magnitsky Act. In Putin's totalitarian mind, this was an ironclad guarantee that it would never become law. But what Putin overlooked was that the United States was not Russia. In simple terms, the Russian response to the Magnitsky Act should have been a tit-for-tat retaliation, reminiscent of a Cold War spy exchange. The Americans sanction a few Russian officials, and the Russians respond by doing the same. End of story. But that is not how Putin decided to play it. Instead, immediately after the Magnitsky Act passed the Senate, he began a major quest to find ways to lash out and cause America real pain. Putin's apparatchiks began floating ideas. The first was a proposed parliamentary resolution to seize $3.5 billion of Citigroup assets in Russia. It was certainly vindictive, but it was a ridiculous idea. Someone must have realized that if Russia seized Citigroup's assets, then the United States would seize Russian assets in America. Our opponents abandoned this and moved on. The next idea they floated was a blockade of the Northern Distribution Network. This was the route the Americans used to move military equipment through Russia and into Afghanistan. The United States got supplies into Afghanistan in only two ways, through Pakistan or through Russia, and Putin understood perfectly how valuable this route was. The problem with this idea was that if Russia followed through, officials at the Pentagon would look at a map and ask where they could put down their enormous foot to affect Russia's strategic interests in a similar way. The obvious place would have been Syria. Putin's government had invested a lot in propping up Syrian dictator Bashar al-Assad, and Putin wasn't going to do anything to jeopardize that investment. So this idea quickly died as well. Putin needed to come up with something that didn't involve money or the military, but that would still upset America. The idea surfaced on December 11, 2012, when I was in Toronto to advocate for a Canadian version of the Magnitsky Act. That night I was giving a speech to a group of Canadian policymakers and journalists. During the question and answer session, a young female reporter stood and asked, "Today, members of the Russian Duma, the lower house of the Russian parliament, announced that they are proposing a law that would permanently ban the adoption of Russian children by American families. What is your comment, Mr. Browder?" It was the first I'd heard of this. I had a hard time processing the question, but after thinking about it for a moment, I said, "If Putin is putting Russian orphans in the middle of this, then I think it's one of the most unconscionable things he could possibly do." This move complicated my psychology. Up until that moment, my fight with the Russians had been black and white. Picking sides was entirely straightforward. You were either on the side of truth and justice, or you were on the side of Russian torturers and murderers. Now, by coming to the side of truth and justice, you might be causing harm to Russian orphans. Putin's proposed ban was significant, because over the last decade, Americans had adopted over 60,000 Russian orphans. In recent years, the Russians had restricted most American adoptions to sick children, those with HIV, Down syndrome, and spina bifida, among many other disorders. Some of these children wouldn't survive without the medical care they would receive from their American families. This meant that in addition to punishing American families who were waiting for Russian children to join them, Putin was also punishing and potentially killing defenseless orphans in his own country. To say that this was a heartless proposal doesn't even qualify as an understatement. It was evil, pure and simple. Putin had hit his mark. He'd found something that Americans wanted and that he could take away without any threat of retaliation. More than that, he'd found a way to create a moral cost for supporting the Magnitsky campaign. While Putin expected a bad reaction from the United States, he had no idea what kind of hornet's nest he'd stirred up in his own country. One can criticize Russians for many things, but their love of children isn't one of them. Russia is one of the only countries in the world where you can take a screaming child into a fancy restaurant, and no one will give you a second look. Russians simply adore children. This didn't stop Putin, though. The adoption ban law was given its first reading in the Russian parliament on December 14th, the same day that President Obama signed the Magnitsky Act into law. The initial blowback inside Russia came from the most unexpected quarter. After the law was proposed, some of Putin's most senior confidants started to break ranks. The first was Olga Galodets, the deputy prime minister for social issues, who told Forbes that if this law was passed, children with serious illnesses who require expensive operations will lose the opportunity to be adopted. Then Anton Siluanov, Russia's finance minister, tweeted, "Logic of tit for tat is wrong because children will suffer." Even Sergei Lavrov, Russia's foreign minister, who carried out some of Putin's most odious policies around the world, said, "It is not right, and I am sure that eventually the Duma will make a balanced decision." Because Putin ran such a tight ship, given this unprecedented display of disloyalty, I started to assume that he must not be behind the adoption ban himself. I hoped and prayed that was true, and that cooler heads would prevail. Defenseless children had to be taken out of this fight. Putin rarely projects his intentions, and is one of the most enigmatic leaders in the world. Unpredictability is his modus operandi. While he does this to keep his options open, he also never backs down from a fight or shows any weakness. Therefore, it was impossible to predict what he was going to do. But we were about to get a clearer view when Putin took the podium for his annual 4-hour press conference. This stage-managed production had animated backdrops and banks of lights, and many of the questions were softballs lobbed from either state-sponsored or self-censored journalists. Even though unexpected things rarely happened at these events, I knew that this would be the first time Putin would show his cards on the adoption ban. I watched it on a live feed at the office. Vadim and Ivan joined me to see what Putin had to say and to translate. The first question came from Ksenia Sokolova, a journalist from a Russian glossy magazine named Snob.
"In response to the American Magnitsky Act, the State Duma adopted restrictive measures against U.S. citizens who want to adopt Russian orphans. Does it not bother you to have the most destitute and helpless orphans becoming a tool in this political struggle?"
Putin shifted at his huge, angular desk and deflected as well as he could. He tried to look cool, but right off the bat the event had gone off script.
"This is undoubtedly an unfriendly act towards the Russian Federation," he said. "Public opinion polls show that the overwhelming majority of Russians do not support the adoption of Russian children by foreign nationals."
He then went into a long ramble about Guantanamo, Abu Ghraib, and secret CIA prisons, as if these places somehow made Russia's own abhorrent actions acceptable. 3 hours into the press conference, 6 of the 50-odd questions asked of Putin had been about Sergei Magnitsky and the Russian orphans, and he was visibly angry. Finally, toward the end of the event, Sergei Loika of the Los Angeles Times stood up and said,
I'm going back to Sergei Magnitsky because you talked about it. Russia has had 3 years to give an answer.
He was referring to the investigation of Sergei's death.
What happened? What about the stolen $230 million that went to the police? That money could have been used to rebuild orphanages.
The hall erupted in applause. Putin was stunned.
Why are you all clapping?
He demanded. Putin had never experienced anything like this. The press was in open revolt. Everyone thought these things, but no one said them. Putin finally lost control. He lowered his voice, furrowed his brow, and said, Magnitsky did not die of torture. He was not tortured. He died of a heart attack. In addition, as you know, he was not a human rights activist, but a lawyer for Mr. Browder, who is suspected by our law enforcement agencies of economic crimes in Russia. My heart skipped a beat. I knew that when my name passed Putin's thin lips, my life had changed forever. In the past, Putin had always steadfastly refused to mention my name. He'd been publicly confronted twice by reporters and always referred to me as that man. He never dignified his enemies by mentioning them by name, but no longer. Hearing Putin say my name had a chilling effect, and I braced myself for whatever was going to come next. The very next day, the adoption ban was voted on in the Duma, and in spite of Lavrov's wish that it make a balanced decision, 420 members voted for it, and only 7 voted against. A week later, on December 28th, Putin signed the adoption ban into law. The Magnitsky Act had taken 2.5 years to become law in the United States. Russia's anti-Magnitsky Act took 2.5 weeks. The immediate fallout over this new law was heartbreaking. 300 Russian orphans, who had already met their American families, would never see the rooms that had been decorated for them on the other side of the world. Pictures of these children and their stories circulated throughout the international press. Their prospective parents descended on Capitol Hill, shouting, "We don't care about international politics. We just care about our babies." I couldn't have agreed with them more. As soon as the adoption ban went into effect, I started receiving calls from reporters, and all of them had the same question. Do you feel responsible for what's happening to these orphans and their American families? I answered, no, Putin is the one who is responsible. Only a coward would use defenseless children as human shields. I wasn't the only one who felt this way. On January 14th, Russian New Year's Day, people started to assemble on Moscow's Boulevard Ring, carrying placards and homemade signs denouncing Putin. As the protesters made their way along the streets among a heavy police presence, their numbers grew and eventually hit roughly 50,000. This was not the usual crowd of politically active people, but grandmothers, school teachers, children riding on their father's shoulders, and every other kind of Muscovite. Their signs said things like shame and stop lying and the Duma eats children and Herod. The law quickly became known as Herod's Law, which referred to the brutal king of Judea who, to stay in power, had tried to kill the baby Jesus by ordering the massacre of all male infants in Bethlehem. Generally, Putin ignores protests, but he couldn't ignore this one, because it was big, and it focused on saving children. The government couldn't repeal the law, but after the March Against Scoundrels, it announced that Russia would invest millions in the state-run orphanage system. I was sure that the money would never find its way to its designated recipients, but it did show how rattled Putin was. However, this whole affair cost Putin something much dearer than money. his aura of invincibility. Humiliation is his currency. He uses it to get what he wants and to put people in their place. In his mindset, he hasn't succeeded until his opponent has failed, and he can't be happy until his opponent is miserable. In Putin's world, the humiliator cannot, under any circumstances, become the humiliatee. Yet this is precisely what happened in the wake of the adoption ban. What does a man like Putin do when he is humiliated? As we'd seen so many times before, he lashes out against the person who humiliated him. Ominously, that person was me.